Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on March 31st, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law.
And today we welcome Ross Silverman. Ross is professor of health policy and management at the Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, and I'm very proud to say holds a secondary appointment as professor of public health law at my law school. Ross is an expert on vaccination law and policy and has two recent important papers on the topic, including one in the New England Journal just this month. Before we enter the deep and difficult subject of vaccination law and policy, there was one point that I wanted to expand on from our prior discussion on the so-called Doc Fix Bill. It passed the House comfortably. And I think a few people, particularly given that the president had voiced great enthusiasm for the compromise, bipartisan, bicameral legislation, there was some surprise perhaps that the Senate decided not to do an early vote and actually left it on the table while they headed off, while everyone headed off for the recess. One advantage of that, however, is it now actually gives everyone a chance to look at the proposed legislation, including some of the minor provisions that really haven't caught the headlines. And there are a couple I just wanted to highlight, and perhaps this is a topic less about the substance of these provisions, but more a note about the strange way that sometimes we legislate health law and health policy. The first is that there are some notable changes to the meaningful use program included in the statute. Meaningful use has been the subsidies and incentive programs for introducing electronic health records. The statute sunsets the penalties that would be due to be triggered for non-compliance at the end of the subsidy period, and also rolls these incentives for using electronic health records into more general value-based quality incentives. And some of that's a really good idea, but one would have hoped that it would be ARC or another fine-tuning quality agency that would have designed this new model rather than sort of tossing odd provisions into a bill like this. The second, I think, is potentially even more wrong-headed. There is some malpractice reform put into the statute. And the strangest thing is that, particularly as we're moving towards a lot more objective measures of quality and so on, the new statute actually says that, quote, the development, recognition, or implementation of any guideline or other standard under any federal healthcare provision shall not be construed to establish the standard of care or duty of care owed by a healthcare provider to a patient in any medical malpractice or medical product liability action or claim. Now, not surprisingly, that sort of maintains the status quo of using the desired status quo of the professions of using a pure expert testimony model for malpractice liability. But I do think it's wrong-headed in the sense that we've all been pushing and seeing the value of moving to more objective decision-making. And using criteria, be they clinical practice guidelines or sort of quality guidance such as these, as being much more administratively inexpensive ways to determine healthcare liability suits. And on either side, I mean, I think compliance with these kinds of quality standards could be as valuable for the defense as non-compliance on the other side. And I just wondered whether you had some brief thoughts on that.
I think that's a very interesting insight about the malpractice, Nick. And I recall from using your incredible casebook that, you know, your co-authored one, that there are so many interesting disputes about the clinical practice guidelines and other standards. And perhaps, you know, if I were to play devil's advocate, I might say that that aspect of the doc fix could be leading us towards some level of federalization. But on the other hand, you know, I guess there is all sorts of interesting questions about to what extent, if it conflicts with state laws, how those affect, or state jurisprudence in malpractice, how that would be settled. With respect to the earlier point about the meaningful use issue, I think that that's a really important insight about losing these penalties. And I think it could be an example where, given a lot of unexpected financial stress on hospitals in, say, the Medicaid non-expansion states, this might be seen as one of those rare instances where there is actually some level of functionality in Congress to respond, admittedly not in a targeted, directed manner. But it does remind me of the colloquy between Verrilli and Scalia, where Scalia, during the King versus Burwell case, said, oh, couldn't Congress just adjust the ACA in response to a decision, you know, getting rid of these particular subsidies? And Verrilli responded, this Congress? ? And I think this is similarly an issue where, you know, perhaps there's some backdoor efforts to help out providers and hospitals. Although, did you say, are these subsidies going to be, or the penalties going to be ended just for providers or also for hospitals as well? Was that clear or no?
It looks like the penalties would be ended for all.
Right.
And then everything would just be rolled into sort of a single sort of sum of incentive money. Just for the record, by the way, because some of our listeners read statutes far better than I do. Yes, I did read all the way to the end, and there is a rather odd preemption clause in there as well on the malpractice stuff. So overall, it just struck me as very much peering into the sausage-making factory and not entirely liking what I saw. But let's move on to sort of our primary topic today and get my friend and colleague Ross in on the action. The vaccination issues, the outbreak at Disneyland and so on, have fallen off the front page to an extent. But in doing so, I don't think any of the underlying policy or legal issues have really been resolved. And I think, Ross, both as to sort of physician conduct and broader legislative levers that are available, I think it'd be great to get some legal background, perhaps, as to what is at stake legally and as a matter of policy with regard to vaccinations, and your sort of analysis of the various legislative attempts or modifications that we might be seeing.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, guys. Thank you very much. I'm a big fan, long-time listener, and I guess first-time participant. A little bit of background on what's been going on. It has dropped off the front pages here in the United States. We've had about 175 or so measles cases in the United States as a result, largely of this Disneyland outbreak. The exposure is determined to have happened sometime in mid-December, and it really wasn't discovered until early January. That being said, one of the offshoots of the Disneyland exposure is now someone who was unvaccinated traveled back to their hometown of Montreal and is a member of a community that strongly opposes vaccination. And now there's actually a cluster in North Montreal that is larger than the original clusters that have arisen here in the United States. There's actually now at least 150, and the number is from last week, so the numbers are expected to be continuing to rise there. This is an issue that has been discussed for some time as far as vaccination policy is concerned. It's a traditional public health power centered around the police power of the states to protect the health, welfare, safety, and morals of its citizens. Vaccination, the way that the United States has approached it, has been through the creation of laws that establish a prerequisite upon entry into licensed daycare centers or into school systems that people either demonstrate a proof of vaccination or that they have appropriately completed an exemption request. And those exemptions is where the rubber really hits the road here, as far as the current discussion and what's been going on in state legislatures nationwide. The way that those exemptions can be structured, there's really three separate lines that can be used for exemptions, and it varies from state to state. One is to have a medical exemption, and that's a demonstration that a person may have some sort of, say, an immunocompromised, that would lead them to a significant likely harm from being vaccinated. The others are, a state may have a provision that allows you to get an exemption if you have a religious objection to vaccination. The third type is broader than that, and that is if a person has what's known as either a philosophical or a personal belief that opposes exemption, then many states, actually now it's about 19 of them, have provisions that would allow people to get exemptions on those bases. And that type of an exemption has been correlated with increased rates of exemptors. The broader the exemption available, not surprisingly, the higher the numbers of exemptors we tend to see, and has also been correlated with higher likelihoods of having outbreaks of vaccine-preventable illnesses.
One thing that I find rather odd about that type of exemption, the conscientious exemption, is it reminds me a bit of some Supreme Court jurisprudence about the court's unwillingness to question or to get into the sincerity of religious beliefs in a First Amendment context. And what I'm wondering is, if you've experienced or seen in your studies of the different states' treatments of these conscientious objection clauses, is there a requirement for something more than, you know, a bare, unreasoned refusal there? Or is essentially conscientious objection in this context merely the cover for someone that has, say, a sentence-long reason for why they do not want their children to be vaccinated or to be vaccinated?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to look at that issue. On the side of religious exemptions, the deeply held belief philosophy can be used in some states in order to assess the genuineness and the sincerity of the beliefs. New York State is a very good example. They have given their school systems the authority to look into the habits of the family seeking out the exemption. So you may say, I have a strong belief, a religious belief against vaccination. And now I can't question the content of your beliefs, but I can see if you are consistent in upholding that. And so some states do have provisions that will allow that type of an examination. A state like Arkansas actually requires a letter from a leader within your religious organization indicating that you have that there is a belief within that religious sect. That would prevent a person from receiving a vaccination. On the philosophical exemption side, on the personal belief exemption side, it's much broader than that. And so consequently, what we see there is it could be as simple as appropriately filling out the form. And the review level that the state may have may only allow them to see that you have correctly dotted all the appropriate I's and crossed all the appropriate T's. And in other states, however, what they've started to do is build in more administrative hurdles before someone can qualify for such an exemption. And this is something back in 2003, I wrote a piece that talked about what I called informed refusal. And that was to require a conversation with a physician about the relative pluses and minuses of vaccination. Now, that in and of itself has been tweaked by some legislatures so that, for example, in Washington state, in order to get an informed refusal form signed, the legislature changed it from physicians to the language now says healthcare providers. So a person has to have a conversation with a healthcare provider. Now, this, you start getting into doing all of the forensics of, well, what do they mean defining healthcare provider? In Washington state, healthcare provider also includes naturopaths, who historically have been largely opposed to vaccination. So this has created a structural loophole in their statute allowing people to receive exemptions. Now, not all naturopaths take that approach, but they are significantly more likely than other healthcare providers to recommend against vaccination, except for perhaps chiropractors, who are also, in many cases, strongly opposed.
So I was very interested in looking at the sort of the state statutory types that you outline in your JAMA piece, and I was quite surprised at the detail in the process pieces here, and the amount of discussion that was necessary of sort of the application process, what you term review mechanisms, and then appeals. Is there a preferred sort of policy answer to these kinds of things, or is the preference, given that we've left that time when those who aren't being vaccinated are just rather awkward free riders, and moved into a time when the herd immunity is actually being endangered, is the actual answer not to continue down these process routes, but to actually reduce, maybe even remove some of the exemptions?
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, this is, again, it's a police power question. So every legislature has their own cookbook for how they have constructed their particular state's laws. One of the challenges we have in vaccination that's different from a lot of other medical questions or health law questions is, to borrow the phrase from the old Saturday Night Live routine, I mean, vaccines are both a floor wax and a dessert topping. They're both a medical intervention. Uh-huh. So a patient who is fully vaccinated is significantly more highly protected against vaccine-preventable illnesses than someone who is not. In the case of measles, as we've seen, some studies have shown an unvaccinated person is 35 times more vulnerable than someone who is fully vaccinated. So, and then you also have this population health benefit that's accrued, the herd immunity part. On the rigor of the application process, it really runs the gamut. I think what we are we've seen a number of states, at least 15 states, have some sort of action going on that has talked about tightening the structure for their vaccine exemptions, or eliminating exemptions altogether, or scaling it back to just medical exemptions. Those have all been proposed. California is probably the highest profile. They actually, as I said, they have a personal belief exemption there. They had some legislation that has cropped up to, by, and it's by a physician legislator, to eliminate everything but the medical exemption. They're not getting a tremendous amount of traction right now. As you mentioned, it's no longer the front page issue that it was 2 months ago. And the sausage making process is a long slog. And so once the umbrage and the outrage and all the snark that arose early on in this outbreak about the need to get everybody vaccinated, once that has subsided, the folks who want to keep the exemptions broad are still at the legislature. And so we're seeing a lot of these bills stalling out. The types of changes I think we're most likely to see are those that can be addressed through the regulatory process. And so those are going to be administrative structures. Can you make it more complicated or less appealing for a person to select opting out than to select being fully vaccinated? I think the other piece that could have an effect in this process has been all of the media attention that's been paid to the amount of time out that unimmunized folks have had to take from being in school during an outbreak. And we saw this in California, where when measles would show up in a community, the schools would say, anybody who's unvaccinated has to stay home for 2 weeks. Similar types of situations have arisen around the country. I think people noting what the inconvenience to their personal lives might be, I think could perhaps, it's a little early to tell yet, but I think that could help move the needle a bit as far as getting people to reweigh their options as far as the benefits and the risks associated with not getting vaccination. In fact, that was a component. There was a Second Circuit decision, appeals court decision from January that talked about this in the context of a New York outbreak of chickenpox and requiring children who had received religious exemptions to stay out of school for chickenpox. And so they protested, saying that this was a violation of their religious rights. And the courts deferred to the state and said this is a reasonable public health measure to take in order to protect against a vaccine preventable illness. Now, if you can do it with a religious belief, which is a higher threshold right, with chickenpox, which is arguably a lower threat vaccine preventable illness, you certainly can do it with philosophical exemptions and measles.
That is such a great precis of the state of play right now, Ross. I really appreciate that. And what I would also just love to hear is, here's an option in two directions for you. One would be if you could just introduce our listeners to your contributions to the debate so far. And also, I'd love to hear at some point your views on the risk communication approach taken by the cultural cognition school on things like vaccines and people opting out of vaccines.
Sure. As far as my contribution is concerned, I've been writing about the powers and trying to find appropriate balance between individual rights and protecting the public's health for a while. So lately, I've been working quite a bit with a colleague of mine at George Mason University, Tony Yang, and we've had two pieces this year published about the structure of vaccine policies, part of which was derived out of a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant, a public health law research grant that he received through Scott Burris's shop and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to look granularly at how vaccine laws are structured. And I was an advisor on that original research. And so our piece that appeared in JAMA in January talks about the nature of those different legislative structures that might be used. Our more recent piece in March. It just went online at the New England Journal last week, and it's going to appear in an April issue of the journal. Talks more about the power of using social distancing measures. So, as I mentioned, keeping unvaccinated populations out of school during outbreaks. We also discussed the phenomenon that we're starting to see of physicians who are deciding to kick patients out of their practice who are unvaccinated. And what we talk about in the paper is largely focused around what the American Academy of Pediatrics has said on that issue, which strongly advises against firing patients for choosing not to be unvaccinated. If you get into the nitty-gritty of their policy, there's a lot of wiggle room, however, that they now give to physicians to make that decision. The language, the specific language itself, says that pediatricians should endeavor not to discharge patients from their practice solely because a parent refuses to immunize a child. And when you use terms like endeavor and solely, that's saying, you know, please, can you try your best not to do it? But if you have a pretty good reason, maybe a more complex reason, they would understand that a person might end up discharging a patient. I'm not a big fan of discharging patients. I think it takes people, I think it reinforces distrust in the healthcare system. And this gets into some of the risk communication issues that you raise with regard to the cultural cognition discussion. We're dealing with, in this circumstance, first of all, vaccine rates are extremely high. The percentage of people who are fully vaccinated is extremely high. I don't want to overstate the nature of the problem that we're facing here. Furthermore, one of the things we have to keep in mind is everybody who's involved with this process, both those who are trying to encourage increased uptake of vaccinations and those who are declining vaccination, all are coming from a perspective of saying, well, what is going to be in the best interest of children? And some may be saying of my child, others, and public health tends to say of children as a whole. And so a lot of the discussion has really become polarized in this debate. And that is not going to, that doesn't help. Let me put it that way. A lot of the problem we see is these messages. There's been a lot of high-profile things that The Daily Show has done some features on it. The Onion has had a number of different things on vaccination. Jimmy Kimmel, very famously, has had physicians come on to talk about vaccination. That almost is like after the purchase reinforcement. It doesn't change people's beliefs about these issues. It's a much more complicated concern when it comes to how different populations see risk. Parents who are choosing not to vaccinate, you know, don't think necessarily, don't weigh risk in the way that science weighs risk. Science weighs risk about what is an acceptable risk versus an individual saying, well, we are introducing a risk into the circumstance. There's different perspectives on community. What populations do you engage with? What population do you belong to? So the discussions about herd immunity may not resonate necessarily as strongly in some populations as it does with others. So there's a lot of complicated. One of the great things about working in this field has been you know, I've been reading, I've been reading the cultural cognition work. I'm reading a lot from sociologists. One of the great pieces that I've read recently was from a person whose background is in folklore. All contribute to this discussion about a colleague of mine here at IU is a social psychologist, and they're all talking about how do we best frame this discussion so that it's respectful, and ultimately we can do our best to maximize the public health protection while respecting beliefs and respecting those who may have concerns.
So let me do violence to Dan Kahan's work. He's not here to defend himself, but the way I read it is that with regard to vaccine risks, he puts it that there is no sharp cultural cleavage that tends to occur with regard to perceptions of other sort of public safety risks and so on, and some of the debates we have. On the other hand, his work suggests that while that cleavage is not there with regard to existing regulation, when you start talking about removing exemptions and tightening things up, then you get into sort of familiar partisan line divisions.
And I don't know whether it's partisan in the red state, blue state way. This is a very there's a lot of different populations that have concerns about vaccines, so it's difficult to have a universal definition of the person who chooses not to be vaccinated. Last year, we had over 300 cases of measles in a largely Amish community in central Ohio, which is a very different population than the one that's in California right now. That's gone through the Disneyland case. That being said, again, as I said, it's a small percentage of the population that is choosing not to vaccinate. Unfortunately, they tend to cluster into defined communities geographically, and so this creates, while it's a small percentage of the population, it creates vulnerable hotspots around the country where the introduction of a vaccine-preventable illness into that community can be it can spread very quickly within that community. And if we're going to bring in some of the economics discussion, it also can become very costly to address that outbreak. And so we see public health departments, which over the last 15 years have been devastated as far as the budgets are concerned, as well as staffing is concerned, are spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even into the millions of dollars to contain these outbreaks based upon decisions that people make to choose not to vaccinate.
And I guess I think that is a very good sympathetic reconstruction of the cultural cognition approach, as far as I can understand it. But I suppose the circle that they want to square that I can never quite understand is how one respects the beliefs at stake without giving more credibility to the denialism about either efficacy or overall risk profile of the vaccines. And, I mean, are there particular concrete strategies that you would recognize as exemplifying squaring that circle? Or is it something that is a much longer-term approach that has to be deployed?
Julie Leask is a researcher in Australia who's done some really good work on communication issues associated with this. And it's a long game. I mean, as far as the interactions is concerned, you're not going to have a clinic conversion. This is going to be a matter of establishment of trust and identification of common beliefs and ultimate persuasion over a long period of time. There's no silver bullet as far as getting people to change beliefs as far as this is concerned. You know, the power of anecdotes is incredibly powerful. Trying to take this on head on, Brendan Nyhan and others have talked about the backfire effect, and they found it with regard to vaccination communication as well, that people who, when you try to correct their beliefs, actually double down on their incorrect beliefs. So I really feel like the legislatures are the places where you can create boundaries within which people may be able to travel without allowing for the floodgates to completely open. I think tightening restrictions, making it more complicated to receive these vaccination exemptions, ensuring that there's appropriate tracking at the state level through things like immunization registry, so you can identify where there are vulnerable populations, and then doing things like social distancing to try to minimize the impact of outbreaks or the impact of exposures. I think our, you know, that combination of tools is going to create the best balance if you're going to allow these exemptions to be granted.
So, Ross, while we have you on the line today, let me pivot slightly to an issue that's raised in Indiana at the moment. No, not that issue. The other one. There's a small town in rural Indiana. Only about 4,000 people live there. It looks like almost a poster for some of the health and health determinism problems that we have in some of our cities and even small towns. It's incredibly poor. I think 23% of the residents live below the poverty line. There's only one medical practice. In fact, there's only one doctor. But this little town, Austin in Scott County, is now at the center of activity from the CDC and some state efforts to combat a surge in folks there testing positive for HIV. So I wonder whether you could sort of tell us a little bit more about that and reflect on some of the public health law and public health policies that are implicated when we have an outbreak like that.
Sure, sure. And this is an outbreak that was sparked through the access and use of the drug Opana, which is normally in pill form, but if it's ground up and combined with water, it becomes injectable in a very strong high. And so this has arisen through injection drug use and sharing of needles in this small community. In fact, all of the cases so far that have been identified, and there's at least 81 of them, have all been connected to intravenous drug use. What has happened is in the last week is as you mentioned, the CDC has come into the state to assist, and our governor has signed an executive order declaring a public health emergency in the state of Indiana in order to, and specifically around Scott County, Illinois, Scott County, Indiana, which is where Austin is located. What this is doing is it is allowing for a more coordinated response effort to be undertaken. So mobilizing, we have a very strong divide between local boards of health and local health departments and the state health department as far as jurisdictions. And so this is going to allow greater coordination between the state, the county, as well as the input from the Centers for Disease Control. It's going to allow for kind of an operations center, a command center to be created to coordinate outreach within this community. they're going to have more disease, be able to hire more disease intervention specialists. And the biggest piece that's gaining the most discussion is this is a 30-day emergency order, and within the confines of that emergency and within the confines of that county, they are allowing a syringe exchange program to take place, specifically reaching out within this particular community. So that's something under Indiana law, there has been strong opposition to needle exchange or syringe exchange programs. And our governor has continued to frame this as a one-time emergent circumstance, that this is not going to create either a precedent or a new state policy concerning needle exchange. There is legislation that is moving through. It just passed out of the Public Health Committee yesterday, I believe, that would create more widespread access to these needle exchange programs in places where higher vulnerability has been determined through things like Hep C rates within a community. But this is, you mentioned social determinants. Part of social determinants of health issues are stigma. And so what this is seen as by those who are trying to restrict the use of this program is that this is a drug use problem. This isn't as much a public health problem as it is a drug use problem. The challenge is, you know, syringe exchange programs are an aspect of harm reduction for a wraparound public health intervention that can decrease usage and increase access to care. And that's how it should be implemented. Right now, we're seeing this more narrowly focused approach. And so it's difficult to say it's good to have this, it's better to have this than not, but it's not nearly as effective as it would be if we could implement this as part of a more holistic strategy.
This particular intervention, I think, is going to really scramble some ideological eggs, because by and large, I mean, there's lots of folks who are sort of anti-authoritarian, more progressive folks who are very wary of quarantines and public health emergencies, say in the wake of Ebola under General Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo. But now we see the implementation of a public health emergency essentially to vindicate and pursue policies that are largely perceived as progressive. And this sounds like exactly the type of situation that would be beloved in the cultural cognition camp for sort of trying to break us out of our usual ideological commitments or straitjackets and to reconsider the use of certain legal and policy tools. So thanks so much for the rundown on that, Ross.
Sure. I would say, as a qualifier, I mean, one of the challenges is that these public health measures should probably be there perpetually, that it shouldn't take an emergency to have these in place. And having had these been in place beforehand, this type of an emergency probably could have been avoided.
And on that note, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Ross Silverman for joining us. You can find Ross on Twitter at PHLU. That's at PHLU, where Ross discusses public health law, as well as the futile attempts of Tottenham Hotspur to qualify for European football. Thanks for joining us, Ross.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me on Twitter at Nicholas Terry. That's NicolasTerry. And Frank, where can you be found?
I'm also on Twitter at Frank Pasquale.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.